You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi declared a caliphate across Iraq and Syria, the Islamic State, in June 2014 in Mosul, Iraq. According to U.S. military officials, ISIS has lost at least 50,000 fighters in the last 2 years since then, and it has also lost much of the territory it once held. Are extremist and terrorist jihadi movements in general losing ground? After the Islamic State, where will jihadis take the war? New Yorker staff writer Robin Wright looks at how extremist and terrorist movements are evolving in the Middle East. And you can find a link to it on the Leonard Lopate Show page at WNYC.org. I'm pleased that it brings Robin Wright back to our show. Welcome back.
It's great to be with you always, Leonard. Thanks for having me.
Islamic State militants have retaken the ancient Syrian city of Palmyra. Were U.S. or other Western military officials surprised?
Yes, and I think the Syrians were very surprised. As the Syrians were focused on retaking Aleppo in the north, ISIS moved its forces into the central desert and took a city that they had lost about 9 months ago. So this is, for them, a real coup at a time that they're under extraordinary pressure across the caliphate. Over the last year, they have lost more than 50% of the territory that ISIS fighters captured in northern Iraq, and almost a third of the territory they have lost in Syria. So this is, in many ways, retaking turf, but it doesn't mean that they're not in trouble. They're still under extraordinary pressure, but the bottom line is they are going to continue to morph and evolve and adapt to the realities on the ground.
They lost the Syrian city of Raqqa, which they had declared to be their capital. That must have been an embarrassment. And isn't there an offensive now to reclaim the northern Iraqi city of Mosul? That's been underway since October. How's it progressing?
Well, they haven't taken, ISIS has not lost Raqqa. There are two huge pieces of property that their prime property in this so-called caliphate. And one, as you point out, is Mosul in Iraq, which is Iraq's second largest city and the largest of any city held by ISIS. The second is Raqqa, which is in northeast Syria and its so-called capital. And both initiatives started the offensive against ISIS in Mosul in October and in November against Raqqa. They are being waged by very different forces. There are an array of Iraqi military, official military and militias squeezing Mosul now. They've captured a good bit of part of the city. There has been a move on Raqqa, but it has taken territory around or near Raqqa, but not Raqqa yet. These are likely to play out over the next few months. And the big question becomes, of course, what then does ISIS do to keep the idea of its caliphate alive, even if it doesn't have the territory that it needs to actually govern?
And what's going to happen to the enormous refugee population?
Well, Leonard, that, of course, is the biggest humanitarian crisis anywhere in the world since World War II, and it plays out in all the different wars that have been produced by ISIS, by the Syrian government, the different layers of conflict in this part of what was already the world's most volatile region. And the refugees have fled in unprecedented numbers, almost 5 million now from Syria, large numbers of displaced people inside Iraq and some who've crossed the border. And you know, the problem is that even if we had peace tomorrow, which seems incredibly unlikely anytime soon, the problem is there has been so much vast destruction that there aren't, whether it's the homes, the businesses, the schools, the hospitals, to reabsorb people in anything close to a semblance of normal life.
And now we're hearing horrible stories from Aleppo.
Yes. And the fall of Aleppo, which seems imminent, the Syrian army in a kind of crescendo of airstrikes has, after 6 years of war around Aleppo, has finally taken close to 98-99% of eastern Aleppo, where the rebels had held out. And of course, Aleppo is the largest city in Syria, and this has produced, you know, not just waves of new refugees, new displaced people, but it's also led to reports by UN officials, by local observers, by journalists who are based there, of atrocities, you know, summary executions of men leaving the eastern Aleppo, missing people believed to be detained or imprisoned by the regime, and purported atrocities against women and children, too. There are frantic calls by human rights groups for the international community to do something to stop the flow of bloodshed around this ancient biblical city.
And many years ago, on one of our food segments on this show, we talked about the rich food culture of Aleppo. That's before all of this happened. We don't even think about Aleppo in those terms anymore.
And we don't realize, in modern terms, how important this city was in human history. It goes back 5,000 years. Abraham is said to have grazed his sheep on its slopes and had donated their milk to the local poor. You know, Alexander the Great created an important settlement in Aleppo. It's mentioned in the Old Testament, the Book of Samuel and the Psalms. And Shakespeare even mentions Aleppo in both Macbeth and Othello. So this is a city that has played an important role in human history, and its destruction is a loss not just for Syrians and not just for people in the Middle East, but for the rest of us, too.
I'm speaking to Robin Wright, whose article, After the Islamic State, Where Will the Jihadis Take the War?, was in The New Yorker recently. Later we'll also talk about her most recent article, Having Tea with Hezbollah's Number 2. What areas have you seen, Percy?
Personally?
Yes.
Well, I've spent the last 2 years, I've been covering the Middle East since 1973. I've covered every war, every uprising, protest, revolution since the 1973 war. But the last 2 years, I've spent a lot of time going on the borders of what is ISIS. It's the first war I haven't been able to report from inside the war. It's simply too dangerous for journalists who've been beheaded and imprisoned by the fanatics. But I spent a lot of time, for example, in Iraq this spring on the front line with Mosul. I went down with the Kurdish fighters who are now trying to win it back. I spent a lot of time during the Battle of Kobani on the Syrian border with Turkey, wandering that whole border, watching as American airstrikes, you know, drop their bombs literally several yards from where I was standing. Interviewing refugees who'd fled the scene, watching them cross that border. And most recently, I've been in Lebanon along the Syrian border, where ISIS and the al-Qaeda franchise called the Nusra Front have been penetrating. There are anywhere from 1,000 to 2,000 fighters there now who are also destabilizing Little Lebanon.
Are any American troops operating on the ground?
Yes. And that's really an about-face after the U.S. withdrawal in 2011. There are today close to 5,000 U.S. forces in Iraq. They are not fighting. They're not in a combat role, but they are advising and assisting and in some ways kind of orchestrating the offensive against Mosul. And that's an important role. In Syria, we have several thousand special forces who are advising, who've been advising rebels in the same kind of role, train or advise and assist. And of course, the most important role the United States is playing is its air power, that every single day there are American warplanes pounding ISIS positions in both Iraq and Syria to the tune of $12.5 million a day. And that has been, I think, the single biggest factor in the deaths of, as you mentioned, 50,000 ISIS fighters over the last 2 years.
So how well trained or equipped are the Iraqi forces, and what about the various groups fighting in Syria? First of all, those groups in Syria, can we talk about them a bit more? Are they, should we call them jihadis as well?
The problem in Syria is that you have literally hundreds of different forces fighting on the ground among the rebels, and they don't all agree. You'll find some who are non-ideological. They're just trying to preserve their homelands, protect their neighborhoods. Then there are others who are nationalist in their agenda. They want a role in governing the state. There's some who are deeply ideological, some who are Islamist, some who are members of the largest al-Qaeda franchise. Of all the al-Qaeda branches around the world in Syria. And so it's hard to stereotype or put them all in the same category. Some of them are fairly well-armed, but clearly not they don't have tanks, they have no air power, they have no long-range artillery, or at least comparable to what the Syrian government has. So they are outmanned and outgunned by the Syrian military, especially with all the foreign forces the Syrian government has, from the Russian military advisor, the Iranians, who are there by the thousands, and Hezbollah. And Hezbollah has anywhere from 5,000 to 8,000 forces there. So the Syrian government has a lot of props. The Syrian rebels, the various factions, are not well-trained. They were motivated initially in part by what started as a peaceful uprising and then disintegrated when President Assad took up arms and used force against his own people, disintegrated into a civil war. And so these were rebels who were not well prepared for all-out war. They were in some ways destined to lose Aleppo because they just couldn't withstand the air power used by the Syrians. And, of course, the United States, in its role, the U.S. runs a coalition of more than 60 countries involved in the war against ISIS. The U.S. has not wanted to use its air power on behalf of the rebels. The U.S. role has been simply on one part of the Syrian conflict. And there are many wars playing out in Syria, which is what makes it the most complicated conflict anywhere in the world. There's the ISIS war, then there's the rebel war with the central government. There's the kind of proxy war between Saudi Arabia and Iran. Then there's the big power war or conflict or tensions, rivalry between the United States and Russia. And then, of course, there's the sectarian dimension, the Sunni versus the Shiite. So, and you find all of those factors playing out among the rebels, who they side with, who supports them, who arms and funds them. So it's not a simple question. And, you know, the prospects of the rebels actually ever winning is probably pretty minimal. But the next focus after Aleppo is going to be a province called Idlib, and that's where they are much stronger. That's where the Syrian government can't surround them as they did in Aleppo, because part of Idlib borders Turkey, and the Turks have not supported the government in Damascus. So that's the Syrian picture.
Although the Turks, what's complicated that is that the best fighters against Bashar al-Assad seem to be Kurds, and Turkey does not want to support the Kurds. The UN High Commissioner for Human Rights has warned of war crimes in Aleppo and has accused all parties in Syria of violating international laws. So is the U.S. aiding and abetting war crimes?
Oh, clearly there is going to be an enormous backlash, or that this conflict, the aftermath of this, is going to play out for a long time because of these allegations of atrocities. There are charges today as well that the rebels did not want people to, or blocked in some cases, people from leaving East Aleppo and going to the government-controlled areas in Western Aleppo. That's not true of all the rebels. It's some rebel groups. Again, it's a complicated picture. But that's clearly a concern that there are, you know, very few good guys in this conflict.
We'll take a little break and come back with more from Robin Wright, whose article, After the Islamic State, Where Will Jihadis Take the Wars, in The New Yorker. And you can find a link to it on our show page at wnyc.org/Lopate. Stay with us for more. We're talking with Robin Wright. Her article, After the Islamic State, Where Will Jihadis Take the War, is in The New Yorker, and you can find a link to it on our show page at wmyc.org/Lopate. President Obama repeatedly demanded that Bashar al-Assad leave office. Does he continue to hold that position?
I think the United States very much wants Assad to leave, but the diplomatic focus over the last few months has really been on finding a means for a political transition that will include both President Assad and the opposition. The Russians have made this impossible now. They've balked at even finding a means for a ceasefire that will allow people to leave, not just leave eastern Aleppo, but go to a place where they feel safe. And that's been a deep frustration to the United States. But it's now clear that Assad comes out as a much stronger player, having his forces retake Aleppo. This was effectively the New York of Syria, the largest commercial hub, psychologically one of the really important cities in the Middle East. And retaking it will give him some new momentum, some standing, and will make it appear that he's likely to hang around for at least the short-term future.
Now, why would the Obama administration think that regime change would work any better in Syria than it did in Iraq or Libya or anywhere else that we have tried it?
Well, remember that the Syrian war began as part of the Arab Spring in 2011, when the regimes in Tunisia, Libya, Egypt, and Yemen were all ousted. And there was a sense that Syria was next. You saw a group of teenagers post, 13 and 14-year-olds, posting anti-government graffiti on walls. And their arrests led, in a remote southern town, led to protests that then swept the country. And it looked like, as millions turned out on streets across the country, that Assad was in trouble and was also next. And there were a lot of bets in Washington. People took pools on, will it be 2 weeks or 2 months? But no one thought that he could endure. But in large part because he saw that the militaries caved in other countries and didn't want to open fire on their own people, he quickly used his most loyal forces to try to quash the uprising. And again, no one thought he could survive that long term. There were initially some defections. The rebels began to mobilize. The outside world began to help the rebels. And it disintegrated into a civil war. And of course, with so much outside assistance, particularly the air power provided by the Russians, he has gradually retaken control of many of the major cities in his country that he had initially lost.
What have Donald Trump or any of his likely cabinet members had to say about the fight against ISIS in Iraq and Syria or about the regime of Bashar al-Assad?
Well, it's very interesting. It's, of course, very hard to tell what the president-elect is actually going to do because he's been a little bit all over the map on his positions on these key conflicts.
Didn't he say he had a secret plan to defeat ISIS during one of the debates?
He did indeed, and then wouldn't give specifics because he said it was secret, and that one of the big mistakes the United States or the Obama administration had made was announcing when they were going to leave Iraq. He also has said he's going to be much tougher on ISIS. I mean, one of the problems is it's harder to be tougher on ISIS because we have to be able to identify where the ISIS fighters are, and they have so effectively penetrated civilian communities that there's a danger of a lot of lot more civilian deaths. But the fact is that the air campaign has been incredibly successful, if you think about it. ISIS losing 50,000 fighters, it has about 20,000 fighters today. There has been a huge drop in the number of foreign fighters. And just in the last week, the United States hit in one day 168 oil tankers that ISIS used to export oil and provide it millions of dollars of income. But at the same time, the president-elect has talked about seeing Syria differently than a lot of people in the officials in the current administration or even in the Western alliance have. And he's kind of hinted that he may be willing to do a deal with the Russians on Syria. And this would effectively, or could effectively, be a boost for President Assad as well. His family has now ruled Syria for 46 years since a coup by his father in 1970.
Trump will nominate Exxon, in fact, is nominating ExxonMobil CEO Rex Tillerson to be Secretary of State. And we've heard a lot about ExxonMobil's connections to Russia and Tillerson's friendship with Vladimir Putin. Wouldn't that also suggest a change in U.S. policy?
It might. I mean, the fact is, President-elect Trump has a wide array of people or types of people in his foreign policy team. The interesting common denominator is none of them have experience actually making foreign policy. The two generals enacted foreign policy, but the military does not make policy. And you have someone who was on the Hill on the Intelligence Committee taking over the CIA, but he hasn't actually made foreign policy either. And, of course, Rex Tillerson, the new Secretary of State, will come in having spent his entire life at ExxonMobil. He started out as a production engineer. He's done important deals with foreign countries, dozens of foreign countries, Russia being at the top of the list. But that is clearly one of the credentials that impressed the president-elect. And so there are a lot of questions, even among some Republicans, about how that may sway or shape his the role and the policies he advises for President Trump, who notably has almost no foreign policy experience and will rely on this team probably disproportionately than any recent president.
Is there any indication of what people or leaders in the Middle East think of the soon-to-be change in U.S. leadership? Has ISIS commented on U.S. election results?
Well, the interesting thing is that many of the autocrats in the region were delighted when Trump won the election. And the first person to congratulate him in a telephone call was President Sisi in Egypt, who is a former field marshal and led a coup against a democratically elected government in Cairo and then won a presidential election a couple of years ago. The autocrats feel that this is a president who will endorse their regime, their autocratic style of ruling, because they create stability, that there will not be focus on human rights or democracy promotion or nation building, and that they will find an ally, a new ally in the White House. Even the Israelis are quite thrilled because Benjamin Netanyahu, who has been in office throughout his times, various times in office, always with Democrats, finds a strong ally. ISIS, in some ways, looks at Donald Trump as a more desirable of the two alternatives because they think they can bait the United States into a deeper penetration into the region, more troops, in a way that will deepen the conflict and help them recruit Muslims, foreign fighters, to join the cause, that it will polarize the region in ways that help the jihadis. So you get a wide array of reactions among a wide array of forces with very different ideologies and goals, but that all look at many of them look favorably. The one country that's very nervous, of course, is Iran because of the nuclear deal and the threats by President-elect Trump to renegotiate it, rip it up, or try to corner the Iranians in lots of different ways.
I'm speaking with New Yorker staff writer Robin Wright, who's, and we'll get to the second article as well, about her article, After the Islamic State, Where Will Jihadis Take the War? Then she just recently has written Having Tea with Hezbollah's Number Two. Before we get to what he said about the election, you said that the ISIS leadership, whatever, has survived, and we'll get to that as well, thinks that Trump might help in polarizing the world a bit more and lead to new recruits. But haven't abuses at Abu Ghraib, Guantanamo Bay, and elsewhere affected our ability to advocate for victims' rights now? Some of the people who have attempted attacks in the U.S., like Faisal Shahzad, who tried to set off a car bomb in Times Square, said that it was in retaliation for U.S. drone strikes.
Absolutely. And I think one of the big questions we all have to be concerned about is how the new administration looks at the region or looks at Muslims through the prism of the clash of civilizations. And there has been talk by some of the appointed foreign policy team against Muslims, tweets about Muslims not being, or Islam not being, a rational religion. And that, of course, alienates whether it's Muslims in the region and particularly our own Muslim population. And that's a real tragedy. We don't want to be in the same position that, for example, a country like France is, where a lot of the Muslim immigrants dating back to French colonial rule in the Middle East and North Africa feel marginalized. They are second and third generation French citizens. Their parents or grandparents came a long time ago, but they have never been incorporated, and they feel that the French government, the French society, has betrayed them, and so they have turned. Now, these are in tiny numbers, but they are disproportionately impactful because of the acts they're willing to take. And that's the real danger here, I think, that there has been an attempt, whether it's by the Obama or even the Bush administration, when President Bush got out and said Islam is not our enemy. There have been attempts to try to avoid that appearance of being the United States at war with Islam. And so the bottom line answer to your question is, yes, we have engaged in acts, whether it's Abu Ghraib or Guantanamo Bay, that alienate. We are not as bad as the Europeans, but there is the danger that the kind of language that the new administration uses gets us into trouble and a deeper polarization than we have today.
Last May, a top ISIS propagandist, Abu Muhammad al-Adnani, said, "Whoever thinks that we fight to protect some land or some authority or that victory is measured thereby has strayed far from the truth." Was he trying to save face, or did he have a point?
Both, I think. This was at a time that ISIS was beginning to lose territory, and there was an attempt, instead of the bravado of we're winning and we're growing and we're going to conquer the world, there was an attempt to say, well, it doesn't matter whether we have territory. We can still be as powerful even if we're forced into the desert as we once were before. Remember, we've seen this scenario when the United States deployed 20,000 troops in what was known as the Surge in 2006 in Iraq. The United States beat back an al-Qaeda franchise. But what happened was they went underground and they began attacks as an insurgency against Iraqis in the military. They went through prison breaks to mobilize and free their supporters. They engaged in a number of different activities. They regrouped in the desert, and then they came back to the world's surprise as ISIS and conquered a country that was the size of Indiana in both Iraq and Syria. Now, today they're losing territory, and they're saying, well, we can do this again, even if we have to retreat to the desert. And, of course, Adnani was finally found by the United States intelligence services, and he was killed in a U.S. airstrike in late August.
And it's been U.S. policy to go after the ISIS leadership. How much of the original ISIS leadership remains?
Well, it's interesting. The United States issued a statement today saying they hit three more of them who were living in Syria, people who had been involved in those attacks earlier in Europe. So the United States is continuing to go after them. The emir, the caliph of the Islamic State, Baghdadi, is still alive. He is in hiding. But many of the senior leadership has been killed. And so that has been important in not only killing off the troops, but killing off the people who are hardcore, who are trained, who are mobilizing and coming up with game plans politically, running the show and running the war. And so there's been progress made on that. I think the more dangerous thing that there's not a lot of attention is that as ISIS has been diminished, the al-Qaeda franchise, which is operating in an entirely different part of Syria, has begun to re-exert its claim to primacy of the world of jihadism, and that it's playing off the extremism of ISIS by trying to appear as the more moderate group because it's working alongside other Syrian rebels. It started social services in Idlib province in Syria. It started its own court system, and it's talked about, we want a caliphate, but we want to educate Muslims first. And so that's, and it broke away, actually, from ISIS and pledged allegiance to al-Qaeda. And that's a very worrisome trend. So when we look at what happens after the Islamic State, it's not just what happens to ISIS and their fighters. It's what happens to the jihadi world generally.
In an earlier article, you quoted journalist Hassan Hassan, who said that with the death of Adnani, the transition to the second and third tiers of the group is well underway, and this could affect the direction of the organization and how it operates. Should we assume that with so many of the original leaders gone, the Islamic State's behavior could become more erratic or violent, perhaps even split into various factions?
Absolutely, and there's a danger increasingly that they focus on the outside world. We may be nostalgic at some point about having the ISIS fighters contained basically in one space. They've called in their publications over the last 2 months for fighters and sympathizers around the world to engage in particularly knife fights and driving vehicles into public space. It led the United States, in fact, to issue a warning shortly before Thanksgiving to Americans in Europe and do an increase in security around the Macy's Thanksgiving Day parade because the ISIS publications even mentioned the Macy's parade as the kind of place where you go, you find people out in public spaces in large numbers. And so there's the danger that we see ISIS change from a proto-state or a pseudo-state into a terrorist, traditional terrorist group and insurgency that will attack in Iraq and Syria, but will also increase its attacks, its plots in the West, particularly in Europe. And as they hope, they will find sympathizers in the United States to do their work for them.
Robin, we've run out of time, and there are so many other things I wanted to talk to you about, the role of Saudi Arabia in all of this, the impact of Sykes-Picot, which created many of the problems that we are discussing, your recent meeting with the number two Hezbollah leader. Perhaps we can continue this sometime soon.
I love that. I always love doing your show, Leonard. Thanks for having me.
And thank you so much for being on our show again. Robin Wright, her article, After the Islamic State, Where Will Jihadis Take the War, is in The New Yorker. But you can also find a link to it on our show page at wnyc.org/lopate.